It's Aspen Ideas to Go from the Aspen Institute. I'm Trisha Johnson. About 20 years ago, the United States started a program to treat HIV and AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa and around the world. Called the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, the initiative has helped save millions of lives and is still going today.
This is really, in my mind, a classic example of how important the ability to work together in government is, because the result was 25 million lives have been saved because people had the will to work together for something that was a common cause.
Dr. Anthony Fauci was the principal architect of PEPFAR and designed the program while under instructions to keep it almost entirely secret. Aspen Ideas to Go brings you compelling conversations presented at the Aspen Ideas Festival. Dr. Fauci is now best known for helping the country handle the COVID crisis, but he's been working to battle infectious disease around the world for decades. He began researching AIDS as soon as it was recognized in 1981 and was the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases from 1984 to 2022. In today's talk from Aspen Ideas Health, he's joined by former Senator Bill Frist, who led the passage of PEPFAR legislation while serving as Senate Majority Leader. Frist is also a surgeon specializing in heart and lung transplants. CNN medical correspondent Elizabeth Cohen interviews both men about how they got the monumental program off the ground and what we've learned from it two decades later. Here's Cohen.
I want to give a little introduction to PEPFAR, because I was telling Senator Frist and Dr. Fauci a few minutes ago, I said, I learned that about that in public health school, I'm young, so everyone knows it. And then I said, oh, actually, I'm 57, so there may be a few of you who are a little bit younger than I. Was that your face saying, I can't believe she's 57? That's so, that is, you're my new best friend, thank you. So there may be folks here who aren't as familiar with it, but I will tell you, in public health school, it was in addition to immunization, this would be sort of the single biggest thing that we could brag about in public health. So it's 20 years old today, and it's a program that pays for retrovirals for people with HIV in more than 50 countries. And it was passed during the presidency of George W. Bush, who called it a work of mercy. It is the largest commitment by any nation to address a single disease in the world, and has helped save over 25 million lives. So, Dr. Fauci, I'll start with you first. That was a real bare bones explanation of PEPFAR. Anything you want to add?
No, yeah, actually, you said it very well. It really evolved from the concept that at the time that PEPFAR was conceived of and then actually developed was in 2002, which was then, with the help of Bill and his colleagues, made law in 2003. Was several years after the availability of truly life-saving combinations of drugs. In 1996 was a pivotal year where a certain drug, a protease inhibitor, were put into a combination of drugs that completely transformed the lives of people with HIV. And in those countries and those societies in which drugs were available, it was completely life-saving, to the point now today, 20 years later, people who have these drugs available to them can lead essentially almost a normal lifespan, maybe 1 or 2 years less. So the thought was that over a period of time, people in the developing world did not have the accessibility to these drugs or to prevention. And a number of elements in society, the faith-based group, myself and my colleagues who would go to Africa and see this, we're thinking, is it feasible to get drugs to these individuals, even though many people thought inappropriately that you could not give a complicated drug regimen to Africans in sub-Saharan Africa, which was proven to be completely incorrect. And with all the credit to President George W. Bush, when he sent me to Africa to determine the feasibility of this, his exact words to me were, and I'll never ever forget them, is that As a nation of great riches and opportunities, we have a moral responsibility to not let people die from a disease that's treatable merely because of where they were born and where they live. So go to Africa and figure out, just figure out, is it feasible? And if it is it something that is transformative? And is it accountable? And that's how it started.
Yeah. Feasible, accountable, and
transformable.
Transformable. Feasible, transformable, accountable.
Right.
All right, we're going to remember those three words for a question later on. Senator Frist, do you want to add anything?
I know we'll have a chance to come back, I hope, and talk a little bit about how we really got there. But it's interesting. It's 20 years ago, and I'd just like to add the human face to what the world was like at that point. As Elizabeth mentioned, I am a surgeon and for years went to Africa doing medical mission work and would do surgery and medicine and had been on the ground through the 1990s, first in the 1980s, then the 1990s. And we won't talk about the age thing,
okay.
But now you can begin to figure it out coming in. And at the time in Africa, it was noticeable. It was in the hospitals, there would be groups of patients there dying of what we just didn't know. What it was in Africa at the time. We didn't have the testing at all. It was called a wasting disease because there was nothing you could do. It was general, it was infectious, it was sort of this immune sort of response. But we didn't know what it was. In the United States, we'd really progressed in terms of understanding HIV/AIDS. From the early 1980s, where, you know, again, the gentleman sitting next to me helped figure all of this out. But in the Africa, it had this human hollowing out of society. That if you visited there in the 80s and in the 90s, you would notice if you were even in the cities, just everywhere, that there was this hollowing out of society, that you would see young people, children running around. And then you wouldn't see people 20 years of age or 30 years of age or even 40, but you'd see the grandparents and the great-grandparents taking care of the kids. And it was noticeable. We didn't know why, really. But this hollowing out meant that you had civil society sort of going. The people who would be teaching schools would die. The people who would be the civil servants. And it's just so hard to imagine at that time. And this wasn't one country, but it was very far from what a person like George W. Bush would see, who had never been to Africa ever, maybe one time for a few hours, to confront this problem. Much less legislators in the House of Representatives and in the Senate. At the time, most of whom didn't have passports. Probably today, most of them don't have them. In fact, maybe even more today don't have passports coming in. But I just want to put that human face on that for you. There were 3 million people a year dying every year globally of this single little KG virus. And again, he helped figure out this KG virus that changes so fast that we had no therapy. We had no treatment. To this day, we can't cure it. But at that time, there was absolutely nothing. In Botswana at that time, in 1998, the average life expectancy was 39 years of age in the country of Botswana. At the time that we began thinking of this, I came to the Senate in 1995. When I came, there was not a doctor in the United States Senate. There hadn't been a physician elected to the United States Senate since 1928. Pretty amazing. So this representative government. So that's the backdrop. That's the backdrop that we're coming through with a virus that in this country, but in globally, was heavily stigmatized. That for many people in America and around the world just didn't understand what this virus was. But although today, in retrospect, it just sounds impossible, there was this stigma around all sorts of reasons at the time that had to be overcome. And I'll stop with that because what was done then, and we'll talk about whether it could be done again and all of that coming in, is what the legislative body that I became majority leader of, being the only physician in the Senate, had to lead against that backdrop, knowing what the great, not fully knowing what the great success would be, but knowing that as the American people, what we had in terms of resources, but more importantly, in terms of U.S. global leadership, potentially to take on the most heavily stigmatized disease in the world, but one that was hollowing out countries in Africa, but also I'll say that at the time there are more AIDS cases in China and in Russia. We don't talk about that much than even in Africa at the time.
This was not easy to put together and to make it happen, and it wasn't certain that it would happen. Can you explain how it happened and tell us some stories from things that happened during that time?
Well, actually, it started off not as large as it ultimately turned out to be, because one of the things we were trying to probe was what can we actually do feasibly? Because there was always this feeling is that, can you really implement this in the developing world? And at that time, there was a drug called nevirapine, which was a drug that was used in a single dose to prevent mother-to-child transmission. And if you gave a single dose to the mother during labor and a single dose to the baby immediately after birth, you could diminish by 50% the transmissibility from an infected pregnant woman to their newborn infant. So the original plan when he sent me to Africa was see if we could do something at least in that area. So I put together a plan for $500 million.
Can I just interject? What you're hearing now in terms of this trip to Africa, if this trip to Africa had not occurred, this whole thing wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
And the importance of the president sending his top science person, nobody knew the trip. I mean, he knew it, the president. The president said, you go, is there something, if the 3 million people, is there something possibly be done? We've never talked about this on stage ever.
Right.
But I just want to say historical, but keep going.
But now you made me ask a question. Did they know? Did people know that you were going? Was it public?
It was public that I went, but they didn't know what the purpose of
it. No, they did not.
What did the media and the world think that you were doing?
We were doing a fact-finding trip, visiting. So we went there, and I came back. It was really, it was such an extraordinary experience. When I came back with this plan for $500 million, purely for mother-to-child transmission, I presented it to the president and most of the cabinet in the Roosevelt Room of the West Wing of the White House. And I presented it to President Bush, and he sat there and he said, boy, this is really terrific. Let's do it. And I thought it was over. As I'm getting up to walk out of the Roosevelt Room, the president comes to me, puts his hand on me, and he grabs Josh Bolten, who was his deputy chief of staff at the time. He says, this is fantastic, but it's not big enough. I want you to go back and redo it and give me something massive that would transform not just the mother to child, but the people that Bill was talking about, the young people who were getting infected. So I was sort of stunned. I said, but Mr. President, that's going to cost a lot of money. And he just said with a straight face, he says, let me worry about the money. And he sent me back to the drawing board, and that's when I put together the $15 billion program, 2 million people treated, 7 million prevention, 10 million people cared of orphans. So it started off as a $15 billion program over 5 years, and we were trying to determine, as Bill said, what were the countries that are going to be involved? Should it be Sub-Saharan African and maybe one or two Caribbean countries? What about India? What about China? What about that? And we decided it would be fundamentally low and middle income countries in Sub-Saharan Africa. And literally, from the time I presented it to him in April of 2002, I worked with the White House staff, people whose names you don't know, but who were the heroes of it. Gary Etzen, Margaret Spelling, particularly Josh Bolten, who was really amazing, helped me over a period of months to finally, when we got to the end of the year of 2002, I wasn't sure whether he was going to do it or not, because we were trying to convince OMB. I became persona non grata for OMB, because every time they saw me in the White House, they heard ka-ching, ka-ching of money. But the president was totally behind me, and we convinced everybody that we were going to do it. And then he announced it on January 28th of 2003, this plan, which you described as being transformative. So it was something that took literally about 7 or 8 months going back and forth. How many prevention, how many treatment, how many countries, what it was going to be. And I have to tell you, I say it over and over again, is that it shows you what the leadership of a president of the United States can do when he decides, or she, that something is going to get done.
Yeah, so all that was going on in the executive branch. The challenge is it doesn't go very far when you ask for $15 billion because that doesn't come from the executive branch. And so we have 535 people who were not in favor, and it wasn't, nobody knew about it. It was really a handful of 5, 10, probably more, but there were people even in the cabinet who had no idea. And I won't.
That was very stressful, Bill, because the president told me, I don't want you to tell anybody. And I said, what do you mean by anybody? How about the director of NIH? How about the secretary of HHS?
Secretary. So the secretary, so I love being on here because he's modest about this. So the secretary of Health and Human Services, a great guy, active in everything, don't even have to talk about it, did not know any of this was going on. And so here we had a president who is a leader, but his world is not disease or public health or Africa or global health. But he had a mission and he had a dream and he knows what America can do, and that's what a leader's all about. But it took the mechanics of it. Even the numbers, the nivirapine I want to come back to because it really was very important. On the legislative side, since nobody knew anything about it, what was going on, this is interesting as well. I haven't told the story directly to audiences. In 1998, I started working with John Kerry at the time, and Joe Biden, both all of us, we were colleagues together. Biden was a little bit less involved, but we started working with CSIS, which is a think tank. And we put together an amendment that doubled funding, John Kerry and I did, in the United States Senate. I took it to the Senate, and I wasn't majority leader yet. And we doubled funding from $400 to $900 million. Remember, we're talking about $15 billion ultimately. And it was a huge success, but a huge battle, because I, as a physician, would bring back pictures from Africa of three people sleeping in a bed of wasting disease, and they'd be dead 2 weeks later, and I'd give them to the President of the United States, and Karl Rove and others at the time, they would look at them. This is 1998, 1999 from my mission trips. And then John Kerry and I got involved. We put this amendment in that doubled funding, and then in 1999, we introduced a bill called U.S. Leadership to address HIV, AIDS, malaria, tuberculosis. Malaria was killing about 1 million people a year, tuberculosis about 2 million, HIV about 3 million. So this was 1999, 2000. We introduced the bill, and actually when we introduced it, it was me and John Kerry and Joe Biden. We did the press conference together. None of us at that time, and this was before Tony had gone there, but we had some preparation there. Ultimately, the bill that we had introduced in 2000 became the template for the 2002, the bill 2 years later, once it was announced. All of this was going on about 6 months before the 2003 announcement, the big announcement. But that was the template coming into it on the Senate side. But nobody knew on that State of the Union address in 2003, except Tony and probably, I'm going to exaggerate, 10 or 15 other people, that the President of the United States at the State of the Union, three quarters of the way through it, was going to say, I'm going to make the single largest commitment of any president, any executive of any country in the world against a single disease. And he said that. Even that was good, but then Congress didn't know it. And so we were sitting all out there. 3 weeks, one quick story, because it kind of feeds into what Tony had said. About 4 weeks before, not the Roosevelt Room, but the Red Room, I was called, and the president, or his assistant called and said, could you come to the Red Room, which usually you don't do a dinner. Nobody does dinners in the Red Room, so I knew something was up. I came in the room, there were about 14 or 15, maybe 12 people, 14 people there. I didn't know all this was really going on, and the president said in that dinner to tell the leadership of the Senate that I'm going to make this announcement. And the same sort of thing around the table, people said, it's too expensive. And the president of the United States said, you know, it's not going to be too expensive. My chief science advisor went down and says, yes, it costs $10,000 to treat a patient. But if we call upon the spirit of the American people and the pharmaceutical industry, work together, we can get it down. So it's not going to be too expensive. Then somebody said it has never been done before. And he said, that's exactly why we're going to do it, because it is in the moral interest that nobody should be dying in another country if we could have therapy and diagnosis for it. And it was at that time it began to unfold into, and then 3 weeks later went to the State of the Union message. Yeah.
So during this time when the Secretary of Health and Human Services would see you and say, hey, Tony, how's it going? Working on anything interesting? What would you say? Was it hard to keep it a secret?
Yeah, it was uncomfortable, but it was. But, you know, when the
You get yourself in these uncomfortable positions.
I do. But when the president explicitly tells you something, you know, I know what the hierarchy is.
It seems like the key to making this work was bipartisan support,
right,
including from conservatives like Jesse Helms, who really turned around on this issue. Yeah. Can you talk about that you needed sort of the whole gang on this?
Let me jump in, Tony, because you really can really fill in the real details. And you mentioned nivaropine. Language in politics and everything in life is so important, and how you approach people. We were very divided on this particular issue at the time. It was a huge hill to climb to get 535 people to move in this direction, in large part because people didn't understand. It was a stigma. It hadn't been addressed forcefully. We'd had Ryan White here in this country, which was very successful. But the idea of taking taxpayer money and sending 15, we didn't know how much, money overseas is just hard. It's hard even today, as you know, with the sort of Make America First, maybe even harder these days coming in. So Jesse Helms, it's all coalition building. It's pulling the very best out of people and helping them to identify. So as a physician there, this little drug, nivaropine, Tony didn't mention, but it cost about $1. And at the time, there were 10 million AIDS orphans in the world. So Jesse Helms was the most iconic Republican, from North Carolina senator in the party. If Jesse Helms spoke, the faith-based community, the religious right, the evangelicals will listen. Jesse Helms had written an article in the Washington Post and New York Times saying that this is a morally corrupt disease. AIDS was. And it's a little bit of exaggeration, but that as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, we're not going to do anything that supports a disease that's centered around immorality. And that's just the way it was. And no excuses for it. But he also cared about young people. He cared about children. He cared about family. He cared about the family unit. And he also cared about people. He was head of foreign relations, people all over the world. So what we did, and this is where Bono, and there are a lot of Bono stories, but Bono from U2 was really helpful. He and I had worked together on high debt countries from the 1990s. And we'd been to Africa together doing clean water and other things. But Bono said, listen, I'm faith-based. As most of you know, the whole U2 effort is very faith-based initially. They don't talk about it a lot. He said, why don't we go talk to Jesse? And I was on the Foreign Relations Committee, and I said, yes. And going into the room, because of nivaropine, because there are 10 million orphans out there, the case was just made that there are 10 million AIDS orphans, and you care about orphans, and it is the center of your faith to care. And the remarkable thing, because antiretrovirals were young, and they did cost like $10,000 a person at the time, Tony knew he could get it down. But who's going to believe, you know, a scientist at the time who says his treatment's $10,000 and there are 23 million people in the world who have this disease times 10,000, you can't do it. But he knew what the power of the pharmaceutical industry and the dynamism and the innovation in America, and if it's a dream that we can all come together, he knew that. But that's kind of hard to tell everybody to inspire them. But if you capture an issue going into an office, with Bono, this, you know, he's a very close friend, but he's a rock star entertainment. He speaks to millions of people, but Jesse Helms is as far apart as you could get, you would think. And we helped tell the story. 10 million people, $1 can prevent an AIDS orphan. And Jesse said, tell me more. 3 weeks later, Jesse went to the evangelical, Franklin Graham did this big convention, brought people around the world, talking about HIV and AIDS. Jesse Helms, because of that conversation, and Franklin Graham from North Carolina said, why don't you come over? Jesse Helms got to the podium, 3,000 people over at the convention center, and basically said, I'm going to support every effort to get rid of the scourge of HIV AIDS in the world. And when Jesse Helms speaks, the whole evangelical faith-based community and said, okay, we're going to be coming on board. I tell that story only because it's so easy today to be divided, to not go do coalitions, not find a common language. And we can do it. We did it then. And so I won't belabor it, but nivirapine, inexpensive, capturing the language, changed the course of history, and all of a sudden we were able to pull people together.
Yeah. Just one. Yeah. One other thing to compare the political situation back then and what's going on right now is really striking, because back then, as Bill said, you had a diversity of ideological philosophy. You had the far right, you had the center right, you had the center left, and the progressive. It was a diversity, but there wasn't divisiveness. So we could do things together regardless of whether or not you were conservative or if you were a centrist or if you were liberal, because the diversity was there, but they liked each other and they worked with each other. That is, unfortunately, what we're seeing right now is the profound divisiveness that we have in our country, that if I'm thinking back, could we have pulled something off like this now? I don't really think so. I think it probably would be objected purely on the basis of somebody being on the other side. So this is really, in my mind, a classic example of how important the ability to work together in government is, because the result was 25 million lives have been saved because people had the will to work together for something that was a common cause. So, you know, you talk about examples for other things. This is, I think, historically such a great example. You know, you talk about the Republicans being really very far radical right now. This was George W. Bush, a compassionate, conservative Republican who just made this happen.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about that last point. So you mentioned feasible, transformable, accountable. That's the PEPFAR model. Can we apply that to other diseases?
Oh, yeah, I think we can. One of the things that Bush was very adamant about is that he did not want to dump a whole bunch of money onto a government in a particular country. He wanted to go through NGOs. He wanted to go through others because he knew that the reality was, it like it or not, there was a lot of corruption, that we would be dumping money into a lot of projects in some of these countries and nothing was happening. So that's why he wanted accountable. He wanted it feasible. He didn't want a pie in the sky thought. When I came back, he looked me straight in the eye and says, can we do this? And as Bill alluded to, he said, well, you know, my top scientist said we can do it. And if he wanted to do it, he wanted it not to be at the surface and at the margins. He wanted it to be thoroughly transformative. And he was absolutely right on all three. It was transformative, it was feasible, and it was accountable.
So why can't we do that for other things?
I think we can. I mean, there's no reason why you can't translate the PEPFAR model to other diseases. I mean, why not do it? I mean, we have the President's Malaria Initiative. You could probably do the same thing with malaria or tuberculosis. You know, tuberculosis is a disease that we kind of forget about, but it kills a lot of people every single year. So there are a lot of massive global killers that if we put our will and our resources to it, we can do it.
And let's talk domestically. I know this wouldn't be following a PEPFAR model per se, but if we can do this for 25 million people, save those lives in other countries, there are people in the United States who can't afford the drugs that they need.
Right.
Is there anything we can learn from PEPFAR to help those people?
Yeah, leadership from above and the will of people to get things done for the common good. And that's exactly what that was. It's not rocket science. You know, it really, that's all you needed. You needed a strong leader who was saying, it's going to happen. You know, and Bill described it well. When we were in that room, people were saying, well, it's too much money. Don't worry about it. Well, we may not be able to do it. What about, you know, the situation of, don't worry about political, we'll do it. And it just happened. That's, you really need leadership and the support, bipartisan support. You're never going to get anything done in this country if you don't have bipartisan support.
Yeah, I think, you know, I being from Tennessee and then as a senator being majority leader, I've spent a huge amount of time talking to people and defining problems. And there's no question in my mind that we can do this again. Politically, I was able to take four Republican senators and four Democratic senators to Africa and spend 7 days seeing culturally this hollowing out. Unfortunately, that cannot be done today, and that's unfortunate because that's a political problem that we have to address. But when you have the understanding of the American people, you look at the model, we had the huge support of the American people in a bipartisan way to do that. So I would argue that any sort of movement, we do have to build that support and we have to have the leadership. If it's specifically around health, it comes back to some science as well. Tony was able to go down and take an insurmountable problem. I mean, this is so big. It was bigger than what I even think climate change is one we're gonna have to pull people together. Can we do it again? We will do it again. It'll probably be on climate change, which is a huge health issue itself. But Tony was able to see from a scientific mind that even though the cost is here, because to make it work, you had to get the cost down, that the virus itself, and I don't know if he knew at the time, we couldn't do a vaccine for it, but he knew we had some treatments like, we didn't have the full antiretroviral, but he knew that we could get there by pulling the pharmaceutical industry, the innovation of the American people, the best of government, which is kind of limited, it can just sort of get the funds out and give the direction itself. But it really took a science-based background and confidence that we've seen it play out, obviously, more recently with COVID, and we don't need to go there. But I just want to add, when we're coming to health issues, the science of it, the trust in science, is critically important to couple to really leadership, and then the coalition building is there. One last thing, global health is a tough issue. Right now, we only spend, of our overall budget, about 0.25% on global health. And the American people don't know that. If you ask them, they say, oh, we must spend 20% of our budget on global aid. We spend 0.25% on global health. And this is probably the best example of $15 billion, now $110 billion, because every president has supported it, every Congress has supported it, and this Congress will too. But it is an investment beyond just HIV/AIDS or a single virus. It sends a message that America is there from a moral standpoint, but it also stabilizes governments. It builds trust. It fixes the hollowing out of societies, but it also builds an infrastructure for all sorts of other infectious diseases because that money was used in such a smart way coming in. And there's no question, this is what I tell my people from Tennessee who say, you know, my taxpayer money should go to my town in Tennessee, that stable, healthy societies and stable societies around the world, only made possible today in this world by American leadership, make us more secure at home and safer at home wherever we are. And it's the best model for that because it's not just the virus itself that we've taken care of. We've taken care of families, we've made them more productive, we've injected hope, which gets rid of terrorism. And these implications are things that are much beyond probably what we'd anticipated initially. But the good thing, the American people have supported through their taxpayer dollars, the Democrats have supported, the Republicans have supported, the independents and every president since then.
Yeah. Senator Frist, you mentioned Jesse Helms, and he wrote an essay in the Washington Post, and he said that his conscience was answerable to God, and he said, perhaps in my 81st year, I am too mindful of soon meeting him. And he talked about that and then talked about his support for PEPFAR. For either one of you, how important was it, the religious convictions, that the faith that people felt in making PEPFAR happen?
It was critical. I mean, there are a number of elements coming from different sides, the scientific element that I represented, but the faith-based community was essential in their support, because the faith-based community was doing other things in Africa that were not necessarily related to HIV. I mean, they had been in that position of reaching out to the developing nations, including and particularly in Southern Africa. So to get the support of the faith-based community, which was very much aligned with President Bush. You know, President Bush is a man of faith and has very close connections with the faith-based community. So even though in general there wasn't that strong relationship between the scientific community and the faith-based community, this was a beautiful example of coming together, what they were supporting, what we were trying to do. So I think that there are a number of elements that made it happen, all together synergizing, and I think if you would have taken out the faith-based community, it may not have happened as well. Yeah,
and I think I use the example of the faith-based community as just one of the big, we could have told lots of different stories, but it's one of the remarkable ones, because you start with the faith-based community work in that days, condoms you couldn't mention at all. And I had traveled with Samaritan's Purse doing these surgeries, 20 different trips to Africa, so I knew exactly where it was. But literally, you couldn't mention condoms, and we're talking about coming in and you know, going right at the heart. So it's really important in terms of the language and the understanding. But that was just one of many, many different coalitions coming in there. I would say the origin, because of President Bush, of basically that we treat people fairly around the world and the equity around the world, that was faith-based. It didn't have to be faith-based. It happened to be faith-based. And so it sort of started there, but then the coalition out there of sort of mainstream America, when Bono basically came to see me initially, and he has a really effective voice, because people don't expect him, you know, this kind of initiative to you know, come from a rock star, or back then, now everybody associates him with that. And my advice to him is that, you know, you got the East Coast, you got New York, you got Boston, you got LA, and you got San Francisco. But if you really want to move the American people with your voice, and we have to do that, the president can say anything he wants, but unless you get the support of the American people, because we write the tax bills, we have to go to the taxpayer, that you've got to have the American people understand. And so I said, Bono, that's good, but you need to come to where faith is, but the reason, but you need to go to the heartland of America. Right. And he said, what are you talking about? And, you know, I do concerts all over the world. And I said, in this country, for these big things, you've got to take time, you've got to work it, you've got to organize it. But Bono, you need to go to Tennessee, you need to go to Nebraska, you need to go to Iowa. And so, I thought he'd go away, because, you know, Washington, D.C., all these rock stars all come up to share their ideas. He didn't go away. He called back and said, Bill, in 3 months, I'm going to do a Heartland America tour. And he spent 10 days on a bus going to Iowa and Nebraska and Tennessee, and I was with him for part of that time. And when he was in Iowa, he would stand up and people listened to him. He didn't concentrate on his music, but he kind of told the story from a faith standpoint. And he said, I know you in Iowa. I hear you can grow anything. And I'm here to with you to grow a great movement. And all of a sudden, everybody, you know, stood up. And that's kind of what it took to come across and change the American dream.
So one other thing we should mention is what the response of the African people were to what had been done. When you talk about soft diplomacy and you talk about winning over countries to appreciate the generosity and the spirit of the American people, it is amazing when you go to Africa how cognizant they are of what our country has done, our president has done, and the American people. You know, I've gone to Africa multiple times since we developed the PEPFAR program, and it is truly remarkable that you'll go wherever, South Africa, Botswana, Tanzania, any place, and people come over and thank you because you're an American, because of PEPFAR. I mean, it's just, it's such an incredibly warm feeling when people come over to you. They say, oh, you're an American. Oh, thank you so much. PEPFAR has saved the lives of people in our village. So, you know, if you really want to win people over to our way, this was such a great example.
And I want to kind of jump in. First of all, on the faith-based thing, also the people didn't realize at the time that most healthcare in Africa was delivered through faith-based institutions. America, totally different. But if you, and that's just an understanding. So the faith wasn't just sort of getting a coalition coming in, but that's the way most healthcare is delivered. I'm not government supported, but I'd say 60% of it is delivered. They're most trusted people in the communities, the physicians and the nurses that are there, so the voice is there. Medicine and healing is a currency of peace. I want to just introduce that to you because it is real. You don't go to war with somebody who has just saved the life of your child. We only spend 0.25% in this country in order to have a huge impact, and so I'm just saying I'm arguing for more funding eventually, but I'm also arguing that if you come in and you come into a community, good, bad, ugly, wherever you are, and you give and make individuals and their families stronger and better and give them hope, it opens up worlds of presence and future opportunity, economic prosperity, comfort, safety, security. When people think about supporting a single virus, the biggest, greatest contribution, they sometimes don't really see the full impact of that in people's lives. And that translates up into communities and schools, and then it translates up into governance of a country itself. So HIV/AIDS is one area. Global health expands that. HIV/AIDS, because of the investment of the $110 million, has given a great platform in over 50 countries around the world. For the future, the implications to me are that we need to look at it as a case study, monumental case study. At the same time, we have countries like China who are building highways going through these same African companies and giving them other services that are there. If we can speak powerfully through this healing and this health, which we have modeled here for the future, but we need to seize upon it as well.
That's a beautiful note. That's a beautiful note for us to end this section of the presentation. Now we'd like to take questions from the audience. We don't have a ton of time, but we will try our hardest here in the front row.
Hi. First and foremost, I would like to say thank you for all the hard work that you do and for the sacrifices you have made. And you talk about health equity around the world, but what about here at home? It feels like some of us are still struggling to find and fight for health equity here at home. I feel like that translates to candil en la calle, oscuridad en la casa, and that would be like street angel, house devil. We're playing saviors all over the world, but what about here at home?
I'll just jump right in. It's not mutually exclusive. We are one world. When we talk health, we're talking global. When we talk climate change, we're talking the planet. We're talking everything. This interconnected world we live in means, by definition, when we're talking principle and faith and love and helping and aid and equity, we're talking it here at home, but just like we saw with the COVID virus, we're a plane ride away from anything today. So I hope nothing that we've said has even implied that we're not addressing the equity issues in health and healthcare here. I mean, it's not just health and healthcare, but...
We have a real serious problem in our own country that you're alluding to, and a very bright light was shined upon it during the 3.5 years of COVID, where the disparities of health and the social determinants of health among different populations in our country has led to a very disproportionate and disparity in the rate an incidence of severe disease in people who are infected. When you look at brown and black communities that have, through not a racial reason, but through a social determinant of health, a higher incidence of obesity, diabetes, hypertension, chronic renal disease, chronic lung disease, that was the reason why if you got infected and you were among that population that are impacted by social determinants of health, that you had a greater chance of being hospitalized and dying. So what I've been saying over the last couple of years now is if ever something put right in front of us but a big bright light, why we have a responsibility to address the social determinants of health, which are not going to be an overnight task. You know, it took decades, if not centuries, based in racism from the beginning that have led to this, that we have a responsibility to not forget corporate memory to allow us to remember. Looking forward, it was with HIV the same thing. There was a disparity in health among certain populations. So let that be one of the many lessons we learn from COVID, that we've got to address the social determinants of health. Yeah.
Thank you for everything you've done throughout your careers. I'm curious to understand what the incentives or political strategy was of the Bush White House at the time of the PEPFAR program. I can certainly understand the moral leadership. I can certainly understand the health diplomacy, but this was in the advent of, you know, 9/11. We were entering two wars in 2002. What was the political strategy behind PEPFAR?
You know, I'll let Bill address that from the congressional standpoint, but I can tell you, being right there up close and personal, it was not a political issue at all. It really wasn't. It was just an understanding of the profound disparity between the United States, which from 1996 to 2000 and 2001 and two, took a disease that was almost uniformly fatal and turned it into a disease in which they called it the Lazarus effect, where people who otherwise would have died were now coming out of hospice. People who were making their wills were now looking for a job because they knew that their life expectancy was essentially almost normal. That profoundly affected Bush. Rather profoundly. It wasn't like, well, let's see what political, you know, chips we can get out of that. I mean, you know, there's always something a little bit political in Washington, but that was not a driving force. I don't know, Bill.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking as you were talking, and I can honestly say that I don't remember, I know with the president in any other room, were the political chips put on the table in a way that it, either for or against it. It's politics in this thing, and everything else has so much politics. It didn't, had to overcome a lot of politics because people start from a different place, and very quickly, you know, the same issue that's a little bit of a yellow flag today, the issues around abortion, how you would go to the conservative community and how would these monies be used. But in terms of either political advantage or disadvantage, in this issue out of, say, 50 issues that were big for me, really just didn't play.
Okay, let's see from this side of the room, here in the front.
Thank you very much. It is an absolute honor. This question is for Dr. Fauci. You talked about you know, science, and as a scientist, we know the impacts of climate change on public health. And in a monumentous way, you were able to treat HIV. Where do you think that this administration and the scientific community is going with dealing with climate change?
42 seconds.
Didn't you just come from a conference on climate change?
Yeah, we're on it.
I mean, it's very clear. It's real. It's a problem. We have to address it. I mean, the argument of whether or not it's a scientific fact that we have the effect of climate on so many things we're doing is ridiculous. So we just need to put that behind us, the nonsense that it's not a reality. I think we're almost there, and we just need to figure out how we're going to do about it.
Yeah, in my 10 seconds, we're at a good point with climate, and people are coming together for the first time. As most of you know, I chair the Nature Conservancy. It's our number one effort out there. And polling and reaching people, translating it into this planetary health and human health is a huge advantage going forward. I feel good about it. We got a long way to go. It's another big, big, big issue. I would say it's probably the next biggest issue after HIV/AIDS, that is the American people and the planet have to come together, and I think we can do it.
Perfect. Thank you both.
Anthony Fauci served as director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases from 1984 to 2022. He was a key advisor to seven presidents on global HIV/AIDS issues and initiatives to bolster medical and public health preparedness against infectious disease threats such as COVID-19. He also served as chief medical advisor to President Joe Biden. Bill Frist is a former U.S. Senator and Majority Leader of the U.S. Senate. He chairs the Global Board of the Nature Conservancy and is founding partner of Frist Cressy Ventures, an investment firm specializing in tech-enabled health services. A surgeon, Frist performed more than 150 heart and lung transplants and founded the Vanderbilt Transplant Center, the world's busiest heart transplant center. Elizabeth Cohen is senior medical correspondent for CNN's Health, Medical, and Wellness Unit. She's responsible for breaking medical news and health consumer reporting across CNN. Today's show was programmed by the Aspen Ideas Health team and produced by Natalie Jones and me. Our music is by Wonderly. I'm Trisha Johnson. Thanks for listening.